Welcome to the sixth episode of Indestructible, Indestructible, Latin America with Rodrigo Acuña. This podcast is a collaborative effort between myself and Alborada, an independent voice on Latin American politics, media, and culture based in the United Kingdom. I am a contributing editor of Alborada and am based in Sydney, Australia. As is common here in Australia among progressives in support of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's rights, I would like to acknowledge that I am on the land of the Dharawal people and pay my respect to the past, present, and future traditional custodians and elders of this nation. This was and always will be Aboriginal land. In this episode, I speak with Clinton Fernandez about Australia's intelligence agency's involvement in Chile in the 1970s and Canberra's foreign policy towards East Timor, Indonesia, China, and the United States. Clinton is a former Australian Army officer who served in the Australian Intelligence Corps and currently works as a professor of international and political studies at the University of New South Wales in Australia. Clinton has published numerous books on foreign policy, some of which include What Uncle Sam Wants, US Foreign Policy Objectives in Australia and Beyond, 2019, Island Off the Coast of Australia, Instruments of Statecraft in Australian Foreign Policy, 2018, Peace with Justice, Noam Chomsky in Australia, 2012, and Reluctant Saviour, Australia, Indonesia, and the Liberation of East Timor, 2005. The transcript for the last episode is now available to our patrons. To support this podcast, please visit www.patreon.com/indestructiblepod. As an independent media project, we are sincerely thankful to our patrons. If you are listening to this podcast for the first time and enjoy its content, please like and share it on social media. You will find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, while all our episodes can be found at alborada.net/indestructible/. I now leave you with Clinton Fernandez. So Clinton Fernandez, you're currently a professor of international and political studies at the University of New South Wales. You're a former Australian Army officer who served in the Australian Intelligence Corps. I have been reading some of your books on Australian foreign policy, and like I said, I'm certainly quite impressed by your level of critical analysis. I'm just wondering if you could tell our audience a little bit about your background in terms of why, as an academic, you decided to look at Australian foreign policy.
Intellectual reason is simply that I'd heard a lot of explanations, and it seemed to me, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it, it seemed to me that there was something being missed, and almost deliberately so, as if we were in the presence of a taboo. And so I thought, well, I need to look further into this matter. And so that intellectually, that was the reason, to work out exactly what is at the core of Australia's role in the world and our place in the world. And secondly, is just a simple pragmatic, reason. I live here. This is my country. And I need to focus on what my country is doing, not on what somebody else is doing. And so for those two reasons, the intellectually, the sense that there was something deliberately or subconsciously being avoided, I felt I was in the presence of a taboo. And so I thought I needed to look further into it, and not using opinion, but basically going to the National Archives and trying to get a sense across a consistent range of phenomena. Is there something consistent about Australia's external relations and our place in the world?
Now, in this interview, I would like to focus on a large amount of attention on your research on Chile recently, and Australia's the role that Australia's agencies played in 1973 during the US-backed military coup against the democratically elected government of Dr. Salvador Allende. Before moving on to that topic, I'm interested in your research on Indonesia, East Timor, and the role Australia played in that part of the world in the 1960s and 70s. Could you tell us about Australia's relationship with the Suharto dictatorship in Indonesia and how the Labour Party of Gough Whitlam and subsequent Australian governments conducted themselves towards East Timor?
Okay. I'll give you an answer that will probably explain a lot of what's coming next in terms of Chile as well. At the end of the Second World War, as it became time to decolonize, a number of former colonies were going to become independent. There were essentially, you know, two major ways in which those colonies could become independent. The first way is if they preserved the colonial class relations. And the second one was if they tried to overthrow those relations. Preserving the colonial class relations means ensuring that agriculture and the peasantry are kind of neglected in favor of an urban middle class, which is connected to the West in a kind of a dependency relationship. Now, if countries, it doesn't matter whether we're talking about Indonesia or Malaysia or any other country in the world, if those formerly colonized countries were going to preserve class relations, then their political independence would be accepted and as long as they remained economically subordinate. But if those countries were going to overthrow class relations, then there would be military interventions in order to try and defeat them, subversion and so on. And so in the case of Malaysia, Britain needed a lot of Malaysia's rubber and tin as a colonial power. Britain needed that in order to get the sales from that rubber and tin converted into US dollars, which it could then use for its own economy. When Malaysia became independent, it at the end of a counterinsurgency operation, it preserved class relations. The guy who became the first prime minister, Tunku Abdul Rahman, was an elite traditional sort of fellow who was went to Cambridge University in Britain to study law. He failed. He came back. He was more interested in racehorse horse racing and basically a normal feudal life. And about 70 to 80% of the country's economy remained in the hands of British corporations. And so it was fine to have him as the independent leader. Sukarno in Indonesia was not like that, and especially under the pressure of the Indonesian Communist Party. And so the aim was to overthrow someone like Sukarno in order to allow, you know, a more conservative or reactionary force to come in. And that's basically what happened with Suharto. It was an attempt to bring in people who would restore class relations. And that's precisely what Indonesia did under Suharto. When Suharto came in, this is with the, you know, great support and acclaim of the United States and Australia, he ensured that his economy was basically turned over to economists from the so-called Berkeley Mafia. That's the neoliberal people who were going to tell them how to not increase aggregate demand or peasant incomes, but rather to do other kinds of things with the economy. And he did achieve rice self-sufficiency, but there was basically a sense in which the country's cultural life was destroyed, subordinated. You know, it's no accident that the top specialists in Indonesia studies are actually foreigners, not Indonesian people. And that's because of the subordinated cultural and economic life of that country as a result of Suharto. He himself, of course, got very rich. And you can also make a similar argument with Salvador Allende, which we can come to later. With Timor, it was something very similar in the sense that when Timor became was getting ready to decolonize after the Portuguese Revolution of 74, the front group, the political front that was formed, the Revolutionary Front for the Liberation of Timor, the Fretilin Group, it wasn't a model of political democracy or libertarianism. It was a front group. Its core aim, though, was to ensure that Timor's economy, its agriculture, its oil, and so on, would go to Timor. Now, that is terrible. That's just a defiance of the imperial system. And so Australia, Indonesia, with the help of Australia, did everything it could to defeat Fretilin, including invading it and then conquering the country, occupying it for 24 years. So that's the broad dynamic. And it applies all across the world. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why the United States intervenes so often in Latin America, in Central America. The reason why France maintains a kind of a neo-empire of its own in the French-speaking parts of Africa. It's the same thing. What you've got to make sure is that the resources of the region and those countries don't stay in that country, but rather are turned across and made available to formerly colonial powers, companies, in a way and a manner in which they want it. That's the broad, the big story, the general idea.
Okay, and just a sort of a technical question: who was actually in power when Timor was invaded by the Indonesian military? Was it okay. Whitlam government, or was the Whitlam government about to come into power?
So I just Whitlam, of course. No, well, the Timorese became entitled to self-determination and on the path of decolonization in April 74, which is when Whitlam was in power. Whitlam spoke to Suharto and said that Timor should be part of Indonesia. Now, Suharto began a destabilization campaign, followed by a kind of a terror campaign on the border regions. Whitlam was in power the whole time. He was sacked on the 11th of November, 75. And the full-scale Indonesian invasion began on the 7th of December, 75, when a caretaker government led by Malcolm Fraser was in power. But basically, it was a Whitlam job, yeah.
Okay. I think, as I said, we'll come back to Timor. Mm-hmm. Moving on to Chile, in order to provide a greater amount of context for our audience, I'm wondering if you could explain to us a little bit about what happened in Chile in terms of how a Marxist government, the first democratically elected Marxist government, came into power in the Western Hemisphere.
Sure. The background context is that essentially since European colonization of Latin America, the ruling groups in all Latin American countries, including, of course, the Caribbean countries like Cuba, have been connected not to each other. There's no internal regional integration, but rather to Europe as the colonizing power, and after that to the United States. The ruling groups in Latin America tend to be white. They sit atop a group of former slaves and indigenous people. There are more indigenous people in some places than others, of course, like Bolivia, for example. But the elite groups themselves invest their money, which they get from their latifundia, their properties and so on, invest the money abroad, typically in Europe or in the United States. And as a result, there hasn't been any internal integration. It's a relationship of dependency. And that basically was how it was for many, many, many years. Now, something changed, of course, in 1959 in Cuba. That was not a Marxist revolution at all. It was only about a year and a half later that Castro began to talk about, well, Marxism and so on. He actually went to the United States and met people. It started out as a nationalist revolution. And that was the first time that the United States decided, well, what are we going to do about this? And this is directly relevant to Chile, because it's the same policy. So the incoming United States president, John F. Kennedy, after the failure of the 61 Bay of Pigs invasion, sent a group, an investigative team, to go and work out what's going on in Latin American countries. And a report was prepared. And that report said the hemisphere is experiencing demands for a rising standard of living. People are demanding more from their governments than what they did before. And they are, empowered by this idea of the Castro idea of taking matters into one's own hand. That was the threat of a good example. It's not that the Cuban Revolution was some kind of a libertarian model at all, but rather it was an act of defiance. And you can tell this by in a very important, but very rarely remarked cultural phenomenon. In the 1950s and in the early 1960s, there was racial segregation in the United States in the South, where colored people were supposed to drink from a different drinking fountain and so on. And yet, the number one rating show in the United States was the Lucy Show, I Love Lucy, Here's Lucy, between a white, redheaded woman and a Hispanic man. Mm-hmm. And it was not considered interracial. Mm-hmm. Because Cuba, this is the spouse of Lucille Ball, was basically what the white cousins were doing. It was where you'd go to have your gambling, your casinos, and so on. And so it was only after the Castro Revolution, the Cuban Revolution, that they became, you know, they were called all kinds of names as, you know, well, we shan't get into all that, of course. Now, this is the problem with the Allende government. Mm-hmm. His first attempt actually was even before the Cuban Revolution. The FRAP party, the you know, the Free Party, 1958 elections is when he made his play to try and get elected. This Salvador Allende is a medical doctor who learned about public health and public medicine through his family members who were involved in public medicine. And then he realized, of course, that, well, look, I can't change things just by being a medical doctor. It's got to be a political solution. And so that becomes the 1958 election campaign. And the United States decided it had to respond to that challenge by an aid program, which was going to try and protect a small middle class and give a little bit of growth, a little bit of hope, but not too much. Finally, by 1970, Allende came, well, he won in a three-cornered race. He didn't win outright, but he got the largest number of amount of votes in a three-cornered election in the 1970 election. And that's when the United States really panicked, because this was a repeat of the Castro idea of taking matters into your own hands, but on the mainland, because the biggest industries in Chile were copper and telecommunications. And the copper industry was in the hands of, Chile's copper resources were in the hands of American corporations, Kennecott and Anaconda. And the telecommunications companies were in the hands of American industries. And so Allende had been talking about doing Chileanization, a kind of a gradual incremental buyback of you know, resources, because you don't control your own economy. You really have no idea how to deliver any benefits to your people. And so that's the deep backstory for the hostility to Allende. The idea is he was gonna take matters into his own hands, but if independence is the key thing that must not be permitted in Latin America. Rather, what's wanted is what's called a special relationship. And so, you know, what the declassified archives now show is that the failure, this is the United States says, the failure to accomplish our goals in Chile, namely to keep it down, keep it dependent, and to maintain that relationship would imply a failure of our capacity and responsibility of a great power. And if we can't maintain that special relationship in the Western Hemisphere, then we cannot achieve a successful order elsewhere in the world. I mean, this is direct quotes from from the United States archives.
Yes.
So that's the basic basic dynamic in play.
And Nixon, of course, famously said that he wanted to make the Chilean economy scream. And then Kissinger also said that, I've got a quote here, "I don't see why we need to stand by and watch a country go communist due to the irresponsibility of its own people."
You have similar things even in 2003, don't forget, with Paul Wolfowitz saying that, you know, it's the irresponsibility of the Turkish leaders that they're responding to public pressure against the Iraq invasion. They're not letting us invade Iraq from the north. I mean, it's basically a deep-seated contempt of democracy. It's not confined only to the so-called right wing of the United States or Australian politics. Liberal imperialism is totally, imbued with the idea of imperial benevolence.
And just to pick up the thread of this. Yes. Part of Chilean history. And maybe you could tell our audience as well a little bit about the assassination of the head of the Chilean military.
Oh, sure.
Because there was a long debate amongst the, you know, Chileans in the exile community talking about, well, you know, should this political party have done that? And what kind of decisions could have been made? How could the Allende project, the Popular Unity project, have been saved? And others have come along and said, well, actually, you know, all of that aside, there were larger forces at play, and the wheels were sort of in motion that, you know, we're going to make it very hard for the Popular Unity government to survive in the first place.
Yeah. Well, of course, the big misconception, which is now no longer there, at least in the factual record, is what exactly happened in 1970 and what happened in 1973. So in 1970, Richard Nixon, who I have to say had an imperial view of foreign policy. He wasn't so much concerned with Kennecott and Anaconda owning the copper industry. What he was really concerned about was what I quoted before, which is this is going to be an example for everybody else to do then if we can't stop the Chileans doing this. So what he was trying to do was overthrow the Allende government. Mm-hmm. But the head of the military, General René Schneider, was opposed to the military intervening in Chilean politics. And so the authorization was given to have Schneider kidnapped and then spirited across into Argentina so that the more willing members of the Chilean military who would be willing to carry out a coup would carry out that coup. But the kidnapping went wrong and Schneider was shot in that assassination attempt. And this so outraged the Chilean public, the specter of their own democratic will being interfered with in this horrendous way, that it completely destroyed the coup willing members of the military's will to do a coup. And so everybody had to go along with the election. And so in 1970, Allende became the president of Chile. Mm-hmm. What happened then was an attempt to create a coup climate to make the people suffer. And they would blame their suffering on the Chilean government because the American role in that suffering would be hidden. So the United States would ensure that Chile could not get access to international financing. World Bank funding and a whole bunch of other international financial organizations are controlled by the United States. And so the United States would ensure that Chile could not get any international financing. Its financing would be limited. Now, if you want to modernize your economy, you want to build, say, a new oil refinery or whatever else, you need American dollars in order to buy that stuff, even if you're buying it from somewhere else. And if you can't get those dollars, you can't modernize, you can't do anything. And in many, many different ways, Chile was strangled economically in order to create a coup climate. And then in that coup climate, the Chilean military led by General Pinochet stepped in and mm-hmm. launched the coup. Mm-hmm. And so the United States then went on for years saying, look, we were not involved in the coup. But I think the declassified record now shows that while that is technically true, it is also false in a much deeper sense, because they were creating a coup climate in order to provide the pretext and the confidence for the Chilean military to throughout the democratically elected government. Mm-hmm. Okay. And Australia was involved in all those things, of course.
Okay, well, that brings me to your research, because I understand in 2017 you attempted to have certain files regarding the activities of the Australian Secret Intelligence Service in Santiago in the 1970s declassified. Now, in 1973, Prime Minister Gough Whitlam was informed that two ASIS officers were in Chile working with the Central Intelligence Agency, that's the CIA, which was there destabilizing the socialist government. This information became available in the 1970s during a royal commission into Australia's intelligence services. However, while some Australian journalists like Brian Toohey, for example, tried to follow up this story, my understanding is that, and I'm happy to be corrected on this, but my understanding is that it wasn't until a journalist called Florencia Melgar from SBS picked up this story again a few years ago. And she published a very good article called The Other 9/11 on SBS's website. And I just want to quote a little section where she says, other accounts have emerged to show that agents from ASIO, the Australian Security and Intelligence Organization, which normally focuses on domestic security, were in Santiago well into Pinochet's reign, working out of the Australian embassy, end quote. My question to you is, when did you become aware of this sure. case? And can you explain sort of the initial results of your attempts to have them the files declassified?
Okay. The first awareness that the Australian government had, this is the Whitlam government had, and that the Australian public had about our role in Chile actually comes not about ASIS at all, but about ASIO. ASIS is the Secret Intelligence Service, which spies on countries overseas. ASIO is the Domestic Security Service, which catches foreign spies, among other things. There was a minister for immigration called Clyde Cameron. And he found out that in Australian embassies in a number of countries, in a dozen countries in Latin America, in Chile in particular, ASIO officers were posing as immigration agents in the embassy. And he found this out because he was a minister for immigration. Okay, so there was no actual sense of ACIS at all. Mm-hmm. It was just ASIO. And he then wrote to the prime minister, to Gough Whitlam, and said, I want this to stop. It is unacceptable for ASIO to maintain or seek to maintain secret files on potential immigrants into Australia when they would not be allowed to maintain those files on any other Australian citizen. And so if there is vetting, if there's security vetting, if there is any background checks that need to be done, my immigration officers, I have already been doing that in all our embassies around the world. There is no need for ASIO to be involved. Whitlam wrote back saying, well, this is a matter that's being inquired into by the Royal Commission that I've just appointed, and we will discuss what if any changes need to be made about that. And Clyde Cameron, talked about this, but I want to emphasize that he was talking about ASIO, not ACIS.
Okay.
Because when Whitlam came to power in December 1972, the existence of ACIS was not disclosed to the public. It wasn't even disclosed to Whitlam as opposition leader. The existence of ACIS was not disclosed even to the leader of the opposition, Gough Whitlam. It had actually been disclosed to his predecessor as leader of the opposition, Arthur Calwell, for another reason, because of a connection with China and so on. But the opposition leader, Gough Whitlam, had no idea that we had something called ACIS, right? Mm-hmm. And so he was then told about it when he became prime minister, look, we do have something called ACIS. And after he was sacked in 1975, 2 years later, he made a speech in parliament. And one of the things he said was, look, I cannot deny that we were involved in the destabilization in Chile. But the first formal confirmation of the existence of ACIS, not in Chile, just the fact that there is such a thing, was done in 1977 by Prime Minister Fraser. Now, in 1989, Brian Toohey and William Pinwell wrote an unauthorized history of ACIS called OYSTER. And what they had was they had obtained, in ways that we do not know, some copies or some sections of a copy of that Royal Commission that Whitlam had appointed, and which was actually, the report was delivered to Fraser because Whitlam was sacked. So these guys got their hands on some of those, some extracts of those Royal Commission, and they wrote a history of, an unauthorized history of ACIS. And in that they said that this is what's happened, that they were involved in Chile in some way, right? In mm-hmm. some way they were involved in Chile. Later, there was more discussion about this. In fact, Florencia Melgar kind of talked about ASIO as well. And I think there was something quite specific that she had found about ASIO rather than ACIS. Mm-hmm. And she talks about that in some of her writings. But the first confirmation that ACIS was involved, the first official confirmation that ACIS was involved, occurred on the evening of the 2nd of June, 2021. Okay. Okay. And I'll tell you what happened. So what happened was, everyone knows that they were involved. You know these things. But a threshold was finally crossed when the government itself came clean. So in 2017, when we started looking for records on Chile and ACIS records on Chile, nothing was forthcoming. In response to a number of requests, not just on Chile, but also in Timor and Cambodia and so on, the government's response was that we can't even confirm or deny the existence of records. We're not even going to tell you if we have them or don't have them. And then we said, okay, we're going to go to the tribunal, the Administrative Appeals Tribunal. And on the tribunal, they have to put their people on the stand, even under a pseudonym, and face cross-examination. And it became pretty clear to them, I'm assuming, that they would not be able to stand up to that cross-examination. And at the end of day one, so the first day of the hearings was 2nd of June, at the end of day one, they handed over a very large lever arch folder with a whole bunch of papers in them, A4 size papers. Now, those papers are all the annual reports of the ACIS station set up in Chile. So that was the first confirmation that we have it, that they were involved, that ASUS was involved. We now know that they had all kinds of troubles and issues finding cars in a deniable fashion. What's their budget going to be? They need to get a safe for safekeeping in the ASUS station. We even know the combination of that safe now. So we have all the ASUS annual station reports. Most of these are heavily redacted. And on the second day of the tribunal, but when we got these lever arch folders, there's quite a lot of them, and received them at about 7 p.m. and back in the tribunal the next morning. So basically did an all-nighter to read through the whole thing and then go back into the tribunal and kind of make your final arguments. Mm-hmm. Because the way it works is the Attorney General signs a certificate that says that the government can make its case in secret. And so we have no idea what they're going to say. All we can do is ask them questions and then leave the room. Mm-hmm. So after day one, I think it became clear that they couldn't sustain their position. Mm-hmm. We got what we want. We got something, which was the first official confirmation, 2nd of June. And then next morning, after an all-night kind of analysis of what the papers said, made further submissions. Okay. And then we had to leave. And then for the next 2-3 days, the case proceeded without us. Now the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, the three members, the presidential members, are now considering our arguments and the government's arguments. Mm-hmm. And they have to now decide how much of the station reports redactions, that's the blacked out portions, can be revealed. So we don't know when they're going to make that decision. But very soon, perhaps as early as next week, I'm going to release the analysis of what's there and what it all means.
Okay. And that's
in a written format.
In a written form. Okay. That was actually my next question was when were you planning to release some of this information?
Sure. I'll tell you exactly where, if you like. It's important to do this.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Where can people access this information?
Okay. In the first instance, I have been working on this production of this release with Mr. Peter Kornblum. Of the United States-based National Security Archive. And we're going to post something up next week or very, very soon. It's very, very soon. But the step after that is we're actually going to have our own Australian National Security Archive.
Oh, fantastic. In which,
yes, it's going to take a while. It's going to take some governance structures and money and things like that. And plans are in place for that. Discussions are being held, which would have commentaries and documents in the Freedom of Information and Archives Act, declassified logs of the Home Affairs Department, the Attorney General's Department, the Defense Department, the Foreign Affairs Department, in order to create a national security archive nonprofit thing of our own. And so that is something that is going to happen. It's just a matter of getting the thing organized along with everything else we are trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. I've read many books from the National Security Archive. I think their work is fantastic. So that's really interesting. And congratulations.
Yeah, they're also operating. Thank you. They're also operating in a much more liberal environment. The United States does declassify.
Yes.
The New York Times is looking at Australia, and earlier this year they said Australia is or may well be the most secretive of all the liberal democracies.
Yes.
So it's easier to be the National Security Archive in the United States.
Yes.
The number of times you've got to go to court or the tribunal and litigate to get documents is much less. Whereas here, it takes a lot of time and effort and a little bit of money to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I can just return to the station reports, I'm just interested in what information is there in terms of the coordination with these Australian agents and the CIA in working to overthrow the Allende government? Were they basically taking orders from the CIA, or they were running parallel?
Oh yeah,
okay.
It's okay. So if we remember one thing and nothing else, it's this: the same government that sent troops to Vietnam in the 1960s and kept them there until the early 1970s also sent ASUS into Chile. Okay, it's the same government doing it, and for the same reason, namely to uphold the umbrella of American power and to show relevance to American planners that Australia is part of this umbrella of power. We're upholding it. And so the way to think about this is not to adopt a term that is used a lot nowadays, the rules-based international order. Rather, it resembles a US-led imperial system, but a different kind of empire. not an empire where you go into another land and you occupy it and you put your flag there and you rule it directly, but rather an empire which achieves similar results without doing that. Namely, an empire is a system in which a leading state or states effectively controls the political sovereignty of other states and societies. And the United States is able to control the sovereignty of other states and societies in this so-called rules-based international order through military force, through intelligence operations, but also through free trade agreements to financial systems which tie your hands. It means that many countries around the world in today's pandemic are unable to manufacture generic drugs, generic vaccines, because of the patent laws that have been enshrined in the World Trade Organization rules. That's imperialism. And in that US-led imperial system, which is mistakenly or euphemistically called a rules-based international order, Australia is not a mere middle power, but a sub-imperial power. Mm-hmm. A sub-imperial power is not a victim of imperialism. It is an imperial power in its own region, namely mm-hmm. the Southwest Pacific and East Timor. Mm-hmm. It tries to deny the sovereignty of those countries by ensuring that their key leaders are educated in Australia, that there is a tiny middle class that likes Australia, that likes to take vacations in Australia, that likes to go and study in Australian universities, but maintain class relations in those countries. So that's Australia's aim through its foreign aid program, its spy program, and all those other relations, the exchange programs, to effectively control the political sovereignty, or try to, of East Timor, of the Southwest Pacific countries, whilst being a sub-imperial power. So it's not a sub-imperial victim, it's a power of its own, but then it upholds the American-led imperial system around the world. So it'll send troops into Afghanistan, not because we care one way or the other what happens to the Afghans or whatever, but because in order to show relevance to the United States, what happens in Kabul or even in Baghdad is irrelevant. What matters is that the United States senators and secretaries of defense and key people should come to the Australian area of operations and approve of us. That is not being exploited. We are not an exploited colony. Australia is a wealthy country, which immigrants want to come to because it's a wealthy country, but it is the junior partner of the US-led imperial system. And so to call it a middle power misses the point of actual power and what its role is. And so what the records show, the station reports show, is that it was entirely done at the request of the United States. Mm-hmm. Not only that, the aim of sending in ASIO people into the immigration section of the embassies undercover was in the first instance to welcome and bring in as many qualified Chileans as existed outside Chile in order to make Chile ungovernable, to reduce the ability of the Allende government to run its own country. Mm-hmm. Secondly, this is something that has not been explored by too many people, and maybe it should be, especially by the Chilean community, not by me. Mm-hmm. And that is, there were persistent rumors, including what was aired in Parliament in the 1980s, that there were two brothers, David and Marcelo Minologan, Minologan. They were Chileans. They mm-hmm. had been accepted for entry to Australia under the humanitarian program. They were betrayed to the Chilean secret police by somebody in the embassy who was a relative of the head of the Chilean police. That's the allegation that was made in Parliament. Mm-hmm. And those two brothers, David and Marcelo Minologan, were killed. They were disappeared during the thing. Now, there was always the question of whether ASIO, because they obviously know that this person is connected to the Chilean police, and the people talking to them, the Minologan brothers and the people looking for humanitarian assistance, don't know. They're not talking to an immigration agent, but to an intelligence officer. There's always allegations that ASIO, in fact, was betraying political dissidents to the Chilean police. Mm-hmm. That's something that has never been explored enough, in my view. Okay, so that's how it all begins. And then they set up an ACES station as well, in order to provide a conduit so that the Chilean military had other people they could talk to rather than go directly to people who were obviously or who would be likely to be found out as being American agents. And so they acted as an intermediary between the Chilean military and the CIA. They set up the station, they spied on Allende, they tried to make the country ungovernable, and they acted as a conduit between the military and the CIA. There's no doubt about this now.
Okay, interesting. I want to return back to Australia, back to 1975 with the Whitlam government and the actual dismissal of him by Governor John Kerr, and what many have argued is obviously one of the most controversial periods of modern Australian history. Now, while journalists like Brian Toohey and John Pilger have drawn attention to the role played by Britain and the United States, in particular their intelligence agencies, I'm just interested in what's your take on that period of Australian history in terms of their involvement, because I think a lot of people just sort of focus on the technicality of, okay, well, you know, supply was stuck in at the Senate and, you know, the Governor General came along and sacked him. And before you answer that question, I want to read to you a section from your book, which I found quite interesting. I think it's your latest book called What Uncle Sam Wants, US Foreign Policy Objectives in Australia and Beyond. And it's based on the, my understanding, it's based on the WikiLeaks cables. And it says, "There," and I quote, "there is extensive reporting on Australian domestic politics as well, based on sensitive conversations with political leaders, corporate chiefs, trade union officials, and other insiders. US diplomats are regular visitors to Parliament House in Canberra. One former Australian Labor Party staffer has said they were a frequent presence in the corridors and offices there, and they sometimes knew things about ongoings within the Labor Party that were not known to many MPs and staffers," end quote.
Okay, well, that is the role of the United States diplomats. I mean, that's their role, is to understand who matters and who makes decisions. And how do we get to shape their decision making? So that's what the United States diplomats are doing all the time, including now. Although very interestingly, of course, and very revealingly, if you accept the point about being a sub-imperial power, that's not considered foreign influence. We have laws about foreign influence. We have laws about foreign interference. We've got laws about talking covertly to foreign governments. And if you try and run a covert conversation with, let's say, a diplomat in the People's Republic of China, you're going to get easy on your case. But talking to the United States, you're not going to do that. Now, there's an obvious reason for that, but we are in the midst of a taboo. And the taboo is you can't say it's an imperial system. You've got to say it's a rules-based international order. The taboo is you can't say sub-imperial power. You've got to say middle power. Now, if you take away the taboo and you actually call it what it is, then it's perfectly understandable why talking to American diplomats covertly, you know, whilst protesting about foreign interference elsewhere, is perfectly consistent. These two are consistent things, because Australia is part of that imperial system. It is the junior partner of that imperial system. Now, as for the Whitlam case, yes, the United States was very closely connected, as was the British High Commission, to Australian politicians. In many cases, what I found when working in the British archives on other matters is that things that are classified in the Australian archives are not classified in the British archives, because key public servants were on very close terms with British High Commission people. And those British High Commission people would write memos of what those people had been telling them. So they knew more about Australian politics than members of the Australian Parliament or even other sort of key people. As for the Whitlam thing, what I can say is that the so-called palace letters, the letters involving the Queen's secretary and things like that, they don't show any connection to the sacking of Gough Whitlam. I think that to say so, yes, the palace letters should be declassified and they should not have been held on to, and withheld. But I think it's over egging the pudding to say that's the smoking gun. It's not the smoking gun.
Okay.
We do not have the smoking gun. So here's what happened with Whitlam. And I agree with you. Let's not worry too much about supply and who did what and what date. Really, what happened was Whitlam was not told about the existence of ACES. until he became prime minister. And he, the entire intelligence apparatus, the Labour Party had been left out of since losing the December 1949 election when Menzies came to power. So from December 1949 till December 1972, Labour was out of power. And so when Whitlam came in, it was with a shock that he and, you know, the defense minister, Lance Barnard, found out that, you know, we have something called Pine Gap and that it's established by the CIA. Now, today it's run by the National Reconnaissance Office, which is the satellite branch. But at the time it was set up by the CIA. There was a national party leader, like you might call him today, he'd be like the deputy prime minister. You know, his name was Doug Anthony, and he owned a property. And the guy renting that property was a guy called Richard Stallings, who happened to be the CIA's man in Australia. And so when Whitlam started talking about all this in Parliament, the Americans went berserk. They was like, what is this guy trying to do? And the irony is, Whitlam was actually not at all an opponent of the United States.
Okay.
Not at all. We have now got records, in fact, from the Chile matter, from the Chile records, that Whitlam agonized for a long time when he was told that we have ACES people in Chile. So everything you thought about in the past about Whitlam was upset. No, he waited a long time, and he said that, you know, the prime minister is agonizing about this decision, and finally he said, look, we will have to withdraw them. You know, I can't allow this. Too much concern in the party. The Vietnam War, Whitlam never took a very strong position condemning the United States for its destruction of South Vietnam. He was, in fact, he didn't even order the withdrawal of troops from Vietnam. Today, people think Whitlam ordered the withdrawal. No, that was done by Prime Minister McMahon. It was complete in August 72. It was completed when Whitlam became Prime Minister in December 72. So that's the irony, that he was actually, you know, he wanted us to be at home in Asia, but he was not an opponent at all of the United States and its presence in Australia. The precise nature of details to what happened, no, we did not have the smoking gun. You can make a circumstantial case that Bob, that John Kerr, you know, was tapped on the shoulder by whoever was in the CIA. But there's just no evidence in that we have for that, as far as I can tell.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you ever see a time where Australia could become more independent in international politics and maybe breaking away, or at least, I think the word is just taking a more independent role and listening to its population in terms of its involvement overseas? And I'm thinking of the case of New Zealand in the 1980s, where my understanding is a Labour government informed the United States that if they were not going to declare whether their ships were nuclear armed or not, then they could not enter into New Zealand harbours. So yes. Do you ever see that possibility?
Okay, so the New Zealand thing is because of a great cultural change and public among the New Zealand public, which is what gave David Longhi, the Prime Minister, the confidence that he could actually say this to the United States. New Zealand remained within the intelligence collection network, though, and it still remains within the Five Eyes network, the intelligence base in Waihopai, which collects a lot of signals, intelligence, and communications on behalf of the United States, Australia, Canada, and the UK. That Five Eyes alliance, New Zealand is very much a part of it. It's just that it's opposed to nuclear weapons and nuclear warships. So that's the basis of it, and that is bipartisan. So across the spectrum, you know, there's enough support for that policy of, you know, no nuclear armed ships in our country. Mm-hmm. In Australia, it's different. But I just want to go something deeper. You know, why do we have a foreign policy? Forget about whether it's independent or dependent. Why do we have a foreign policy in the first place? Why does any country have a foreign policy? You have a foreign policy so you can give effect to your domestic policy. Mm-hmm. That's the obvious thing. You know, why do you bother dealing with the rest of the world so you can give effect to your own policy? You can, do what you need to do in the world domestically. Okay, that's what we need to be able to do. And this is not it's a very good point, but it's not my point. It's by Paul Hasluck, a former foreign minister, perhaps the best explainer of foreign policy to become foreign minister of Australia. And he said, we have a foreign policy so we can give effect to our domestic policy. Now, Australia does not have an independent economy. We have a dependent economy, okay? We are part of a global value chain where our major exports are almost all identical in sector to third world countries' exports. We don't have smart manufacturing as a key export. We export iron ore, we export wheat, we export beef, we export copper, bauxite, things like that. We export primary products and agricultural products. Okay, that's what third world countries do. We have a tourism sector. That's what you can find in Bali. Yes, we used to, before the pandemic, have a major export sector in education, higher education. And of course, that is true. And to a large extent, it's also the case that we have this because the government isn't funding the higher education sector that well. So you got to go overseas for students. But we have a dependent economy. The wealth of the country, for example, if you look at the stock exchange, the top 20 companies on the stock exchange account for almost 50% of all the capital in the stock exchange, right? 15 of those companies are majority owned by the United States, by US-based investors. We don't own our own stock exchange as a majority. So the wealthiest company, the largest company on the stock exchange by market capitalization is BHP. BHP is 72% American owned. The second largest is Rio Tinto, 65% American owned. The Commonwealth Bank, 65% American owned. You know, you can't have an independent foreign policy if you've got a dependent economy. So until you have a dependent economy, and this is the legacy of the British Empire in Australia, which built ports in the major colonies, which became states. Those ports were going to connect Australia to Britain, not internal connection. So today, you know, you can't take a train from Melbourne to Sydney because the railway lines are a different gauge. And that's because of the lack of internal integration. It's a result of being a wealthy but dependent economy. That is the economic component of sub-imperialism. It's important to get that point. And yes. So, you know, when will we have an independent foreign policy? When we have an independent economy in order to make an independent foreign policy work.
Okay. Interesting.
And we also, I mean, and this is also tied to culture. So if you look at the biggest supporters of so-called Australian sovereignty and against foreign influence in the parliament, you have people like Kimberly Kitching, Andrew Hastie. They formed a group called the Wolverines, which is a group of members of parliament, not just in Australia, but in the United Kingdom and elsewhere, who are going to fight for the rules-based international order. They got the name the Wolverines from a 1980s American movie of teenagers. So I think there is a very revealing point in this, which is their highest aspiration as Australian patriots is to defend the United States or to gain their inspiration and their cultural references from a 1980s American movie defending the American homeland. And that, I think, is the cultural expression of sub-imperialism.
I used to use a section at the beginning of that film when I lectured at Macquarie University, because the sort of the blatant Cold War propaganda was just so obvious.
I haven't seen it, but I know more or less what it is.
It's horrific. It is. It's almost a comedy.
But even if it was a marvelous film, the salient point here is that they see no contradiction between being loyal Americans and loyal Australians.
Yes,
that's sub-imperialism.
Yes. Returning to the Asia Pacific region and Australia's immediate relationship with its neighbours and China. Do you think Australian political leaders will continue to be imprudent in terms of following US efforts to militarily encircle China? And do you think that Australia might eventually have to, will eventually become involved in some sort of conflict with China, given the, you know, severity of how such a conflict could end?
If the United States is involved, Australia will be involved.
Okay. That simple. Okay.
Absolutely. And in the way the United States wants us to be involved.
Okay.
So, for example, if it is felt that we need to have to make Taiwan a very unattractive proposition for China to take over by raising a guerrilla resistance in the mountains. Like Taiwan is about 60% the size of Tasmania, and it's a very hot leaf-like kind of island, but it's got a very rugged mountainous spine. All its major ports and airfields are on the western side, close to the Chinese mainland, but in the middle and on the side, on the east, there are these heavy mountainous areas. So if the United States says, we want to raise a guerrilla resistance in Taiwan, you can guarantee you that the Australian Commando Regiment will be there alongside the United States raising him up. It's called special warfare. If what's needed is basing rights for US ships, we will give it to them. That should not be in any doubt at all.
Okay.
I would add, in case you might, because this might be in the back of your head, well, what about the casualties? What about the danger? What about the nuclear threats and so
yes.
on? They know this. Mm-hmm. They already know this. What our policy planners are worried about more than anything else is that some other country in the region will become more attractive to the United States, which will then go and use them. Okay, to tell our policy planners that the United States has an unsentimental, cold-blooded attitude to politics, it's not going to surprise the policy planners. They already know that. They know that at its core, the Australia-US relationship is not one of mateship, but it's a transactional relationship between very, very unequal partners. Mm-hmm. They know that. What they're worried about is some other country in the region is going to be more attractive to the US. And so as the US becomes more and more threatened in the area near Taiwan, as China gets more and more powerful and closer to its own mainland, the United States is just going to start, it's already started withdrawing its troops from Okinawa. And at some point, if China says it's strong enough to expel the United States and its garrison from Guam, our policy planners would welcome that, because it would allow more American forces to be based in Australia and thereby make us more relevant to the United States. That's their primary concern, not anything else.
Wow. Interesting, fascinating, and alarming, and quite alarming. I'll finish off returning back to Timor. I'm just interested in the Australian public becoming more involved in the decision-making process, because I think in one of your books on Timor, you talked about that, how Australian policy planners were conscious of, keeping things away from public eyes because of the massive atrocities that were taking place by the Indonesian military in East Timor. So do you ever see a time where the Australian public could become more involved in foreign policy?
Oh yeah, it's some of this relates is within our own hands. This radio or video conversation you and I are having contributes to that. The more one does, the more one helps organize, educate, and organize. Timor has kind of slipped off the public attention due to the pandemic and a number of other things, like the precarious nature of our own workforce. But an optimistic, energized population throws up optimistic, energized, and honest leaders and organizers. And when that happens, yes, it will be possible for us to take a greater interest, not just in Timor, but in the other countries of the Southwest Pacific, where we are an imperial power. See, we're a sub-imperial power. So we have our own little empire, which I define as controlling the political sovereignty of those countries. And until that is understood by our public, the idea of shaking our sub-imperial status is not going to happen. But you know, it could change with time and with pressure. One should not simply give up with these things. You know, you got to pick the fights that need fighting, not just the fights you think you can win.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, Professor Clinton Fernandez from the University of New South Wales, Professor in International and Political Studies, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you here at Indestructible.
Oh, thank you very much for the opportunity and for taking the trouble to, you know, to do the research and to contact me. I appreciate it.
That concludes the sixth episode of Indestructible. As always, I would like to thank Alborada for this opportunity to host Indestructible, Indestructible. And I would like to encourage our listeners to support this podcast on Patreon. You can do this for as little as the price of one cup of coffee a month. My sincere thanks, as always, go to Alborada's founder and co-editor, Pablo Navarrete, who produces this podcast. If you have any feedback on this episode, please write to us on our email, which you will find on the Alborada website. We'll be back soon with episode 7, but until then, goodbye and stay safe.